Hello, everybody, and welcome to the digitally downloaded podcast, otherwise known this week as the Pervcast. We have a lot of stuff to talk about with regards to games and sex this week, which should be a good, fun conversation. As usual, we got a whole bunch of different people on. We had to have Ginny on because this is Ginny's topic. Hello, Ginny.
Oh, well, thanks. Hi, everyone.
And we've also got Harvard on this week. Hello, Harvard. How are you doing?
I don't know what I'm doing here.
Harvard's going to have opinions. You wait and see. All right. So we'll get through a bit of the customary Hatsune Miku music. We'll try and pick a sexy track to set the mood, and then we'll get talking. And welcome back. So, yes, we decided this week we wanted to talk about sex themes and games, mostly as a result, I guess, of the controversy that happened over the week, where a certain journalist who shall not be mentioned wrote a piece in which he accused everybody who likes certain types of Japanese games as being a pervert or a pedophile, to be precise. And of course, that being not true and stuff. Tended to piss off people who happen to like those kinds of games, and the internet being the internet, it all exploded. And yeah, that obviously created the usual discussion that we have every 6 months to a year, where we talk about whether Japanese games are exploitative or whether they're sexist or so on and so forth, and whether the people that play those games have mental problems. So I guess, yeah, I mean, gee, obviously you have you're a fan of a lot of the games that people tend to deride as being perverse. And as what are your thoughts about being labeled as these various things? And people tend to think that these games are designed exclusively for men, and obviously that's not the case. So, I mean, what are your thoughts there, and how do you tend to respond, I guess, to this, semi-regular controversy that pops up in the industry?
Well, every time it comes around, I sort of shake my head and I sigh and I decide to never read an article from the outlet ever again. I just think it's just, I mean, I've said some pretty harsh things in reviews to criticize games, but I've never written a review about a game and criticize people that actually play it. I mean, I am very open about how I don't like games like Call of Duty World War II, and I'm not gonna like Anthem, and I am fundamentally opposed to games like Outlast. But I would, you know, I don't think I would ever stoop so far as to call someone that liked one of those games, you know, a murderer or a serial killer or, you know, like scum of the earth, you know. I mean, so I mean, to me, it kind of always feels needlessly personal. I think that if you want to be a games journalist, you don't need to criticize consumers of games. But generally, whenever every time I see an article like this, I just think that that person that wrote it doesn't get out of the house at all. You know, I mean, it's like women can play games that have women in swimsuits or sexualized outfits or anything really. I mean, it's 21st century now. Obviously, not all men are heterosexual. Not all men want to see, you know, something like Sunrun Kagura. And I mean, like, I think that calling a game perverted garbage is quite irresponsible. I mean, as a woman, I play these games, and I obviously can't speak for other women. I know there are women out there who, maybe for religious reasons or personal reasons, aren't going to be comfortable with that amount of nudity, and that's fine. I think just don't consume it. I mean, for me, these games, you know, I really hate articles that kind of moralize at you from a higher ground, where they're written by a man, and they tell you that a game is quote unquote rapey, or a game is objective, you know, objectifying women, or a game is doing this and doing that to women. And I mean, forgive me if I take the opinion of some random man that I've never met before with a grain of salt when I play these games all the time. And a lot of the time, the games that people call disgusting, like Senran Kagura or Valkyrie Drive, they're not meant to be titillating. You know, like they're parodies of what is erotic. Like no one would ever think that grabbing a girl, you know, with large mechanized Gundam hands is sexy. No one thinks that having really, really exaggerated breasts and an awful personality is sexy. You know?
I guess it's interesting, isn't it, that like we generally accept that people can enjoy violent games without those violent games having an impact on, you know, the kind of person that they are. So, you know,
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
you can be an office worker and have, you know, a very productive job, you know, be happily married, have kids, do all of that kind of stuff, and then come home and put Call of Duty on and enjoy Call of Duty because, you know, it's a release or it's an escape or it's just something that you enjoy doing. And we don't think that that reflects badly on you as a person. We don't think that if you play Call of Duty, you must want to pick up a gun and start shooting people in the real world. So it's
Yep.
always interesting to me that, you know, if I was, if, you know, if I say that, you know, I like Dead or Alive Extreme, for example, and you know, I like to come home after a busy day. Well, I work from home, but I like to after a
Go,
particular.
yeah, to go to the living room.
Yeah, after a busy day from work, I leave my home office and then I go to the living room and I put Dead or Alive Extreme on to relax. And then people, you know, immediately then have assumptions that I must be some loser that kind of never leaves a home, which is, I guess, technically true. But yeah, no, yeah, I have a good job and I'm happily married and all of that kind of stuff. And I just like these kinds of games. And yet people have these assumptions about me as a result of what games I like to play, that they don't have for somebody that likes Call of Duty or whatever. So yeah, I find that difference in view very interesting, and I don't understand where it comes from. I've tried to understand where it comes from. I've tried to understand why people have that resistance to games with sexualized content versus where, and they have the exact opposite reaction, I guess, to games with violent content. And I've never actually kind of understood why.
Yeah,
Don't
me
have theories
either.
even because I just don't understand where how somebody can look at these two things and say, well, one is obviously, you know, immoral and you know, reflects badly on the people that play it, and the other one is, you know, there is no morality question about playing the other one. So, yeah. I don't know, Harvard, you got any thoughts about this?
I just want to give, like, a slightly different opinion to what Ginny says. And I'll mostly use Senran Kagura as an example. I know we'll talk about that a lot later today. Mm-hmm. But I feel like a lot of the reviewers of these games who then go out and criticize it for being, like, worthless trash because it's just sexualized content, they really do the games and the developers this huge disservice because they basically brush aside everything else that the developers have done on the title. They just throw the concept of it being a game away because it's got some of that content in that. And I've noticed this for a lot of games. Like, for example, Matt's a big fan of the Record of Agarest War, I think it's called.
Yes.
And it's like, if you take the overall playtime of that game, like 0.05% of it is any kind of sexual content, but that's what everyone mentions in the reviews. Mm-hmm. Like, it. And if you talk to people who played Senran Kagura a lot, they'll tell you about how deep the combat mechanics are. They're really, really complicated because you could cancel out of certain animations and then go back and do all this crazy stuff. And reviewers just didn't bother to look at that because they went straight for the content, the sexual content, and then they just made that a big show. Mm. And I feel like that's missing out on a lot of the merit of that these games can have.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Dead or Alive is another good example of that because, you know, everybody looks at the women and the assets in Dead or Alive and kind of dismisses the game based on that. But, you know, there's a huge community of people out there that, you know, love the combat system and think it's, you know, the strongest combat system of fighting games out there. So
I will contest you on that one.
I happen to be one of those people. I do think it's the strongest fighting game, putting aside the visual assets. I think that, you know, the way that the combat flows suits me as a player better than, you know, any other fighting game. I prefer to play Dead or Alive than Tekken, even if there was no female characters and stuff in it. So, yeah, I know you don't agree with me, Harvard, but I'm sorry.
It's gonna plug. Everyone, yeah, go play Guilty Gear. Guilty Gear is great.
Guilty Gear is good.
I like Guilty Gear.
There we go. Everyone's happy again.
But yeah, I completely agree with you. I think what these critics and not just critics, you know, people on Twitter, random people on Twitter, have been abusing me all week for having opinions about this stuff. And you know, you've got forums. NeoGAF is quite famous for being anti anything with anime girls. It's the entire community, and the entire community does do the game developers themselves an injustice by labeling games this way. And we'll probably talk about that a bit more in the second section anyway. But, you know, a lot of the game developers don't intend for these games to be sexy or sexualized in the same way that people attribute them to. So, yeah. It's just interesting, I guess, how limited people think about these kinds of anime games, how quickly they are to dismiss them without properly looking into them, without looking into what these games are saying or doing. I mean, another good example is the Hyperdimension Neptunia series is often dismissed, derided for its sexual content and the assumption that it's you know, demeaning towards women and so on and so forth. Of course, the producer and the artist behind that series are both women. So, to your point, Ginny, I guess people often forget that women are involved with this industry as well, and they do sometimes like games with sexy anime girls.
Yeah, I guess it's just always, I really hate it when the thing that gets trotted out the most is that women are somehow these victims of this, like, scheme on the developer's part to, like, degrade you and make you feel terrible when probably a lot of the artists are actually women on these games. So, I don't know. I mean, I think it's very hard for me to read articles like this because obviously games are a big part of my life. And it's just, you know, it's just rude. It's just not polite. And I mean, I think that a lot of people that are out there saying that women have no agency and are being objectified should think about how they affect that lack of agency by trying to offer up, you know, opinions on behalf of women overall as men. I just think that that's a whole other can of worms. I just think that no one game reviewer can speak for all women. And it certainly shouldn't be a random guy who played a game for 10 minutes and gave it, I don't know, 0 out of 5 and said that it was basically perverted, pedophilic garbage.
About sexy games, and I guess the perception that some games, or that you know, people in the media and whatever have, that some games are sexy, and we don't kind of believe they are. You know, we were talking about you know, off show. We were talking about games like, you know, Senran Kagura to talk about the one that we were focusing on in the last section. You know, it's often considered to be this example of, you know, sexualization in a game and so on and so forth. But is it a sexy game? I kind of argue it's not. Mostly because it is just so exaggerated and so over the top, and the actual mechanics of the game beyond that don't really support the idea that, you know, hey, this is sexy. It's not. Yeah, it's not the kind of game that you'd play to get in the mood, really. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, Ginny, would you consider Senran sexy?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, obviously it is a game that has sexualized content, like you were saying, and it's hard to not. I think, you know, I can agree with some people that having women, obviously, in a bikini, she's moving around very rapidly with little to no breast support, that is sexualized content. But, you know, and I'm like I said earlier, I'm not going to, you know, dim the lights and put on some mood music when I play Senran Kagura. Like, it's not a sexy game to me. I just think that you can have content that looks sexualized or has all the hallmarks of what people would consider to be sexualized, like underwear showing, or and some, you know, some games people think lesbianism is apparently something that makes the game automatically sexy, which is ridiculous, but that's the opinion that people have. And, like, I think that just having one or two of those things, which, I don't know, happens to be gay women, girl on girl, or bikinis, like, that doesn't make a game sexy, because often those are parodies. Like, the depictions of women or sex in those games are often satirical. I mean, I've never looked at Senran Kagura and gone, you know, this is the kind of woman that I want to date in my lifetime. You know, I never looked at any of the characters and gone, this woman is so sexy, so desirable, this is so erotic. It's just, I think it's all really, it's funny. To me, the game is actually amusing because of how they push the envelope in terms of, you know, the physique of the characters and their personalities. I don't think it's sexy. I think it's hilarious.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the Japanese have a very long, you know, tradition of finding sexuality to be amusing as opposed to erotic. And, you know, we see a lot of that come through the video games. And I'd suggest that most of the ones that get have this label of being, you know, sexualized are certainly sexualized, but they're not sexy. Dead or Alive being another good example, at least the fighting game side of things. I think those are satirical in nature and so exaggerated that it's just ridiculous and designed to be funny. I think the extreme beach volleyball games are another matter. I think those do tend to try to be more sexy in tone.
Yeah, I think so as well.
I mean, they have the voyeurism in the photography kind of sections, and they've got, you know, it's mostly just, you know, beautiful women lazing around in swimwear, and that certainly has a different tone to it compared to the fighting games. But I think other than that, I'm kind of struggling to try and think of a game that gets derided for being sexualized that genuinely tries to be sexy. I mean, you've got Galgun, which was banned in New Zealand.
And oh, God, don't even get me started on that.
It's not even remotely erotic.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I mean, they banned another game recently, didn't they, in New Zealand?
Criminal Girls.
Criminal Girls,
which is also too ridiculous to possibly consider erotic. I mean, that game actually takes after the whole exploitation cinema tradition and mostly satirizes it. I don't think that can be considered one. I can't actually think of too many Japanese games that are considered, are actually, yeah, people talk about in terms of the way that they present sex as being also erotic. I think there are some Japanese games that do have genuinely sexy themes or moments to them. We were talking before about the Persona series. I think Persona games generally have a character whose, you know, sex appeal and whose character arc is kind of built around her sexuality. You know, Persona 4.
Yeah.
Persona 4 has Risei, who's obviously something of a sex icon within video game characters. Persona 5 has Anne, who's basically Risei but blonde. But yeah, I mean, those are small sections within the overall game, but they're certainly games which are examples of attempts to do sex and erotic themes quite seriously. What we see, I guess, where we see a lot of attempts to do sex with eroticism without that kind of humorous overtone tends to actually be in the Western game development side of things, I find. And I think BioWare is probably the one that does it the most.
Yeah, I think in RPGs, having that relationship system is sort of what is the quote-unquote, sorry, poor choice of words here, breeding ground for that sort of portrayal.
Looking at Mass Effect, for example, you know, Mass Effect has that overall story arc of, you know, saving the universe from the Reapers, and that's all well and good. But for me, the real strength of storytelling in Mass Effect was always about the characters, and the characters are all sexy without being sexualized. You know, Garrus is like a super hot dude who, if I was inclined that way, I'd certainly have the hots for. And that's not because he has, you know, bulging package in his pants. Because
he's got a huge gun.
He's got a great gun. Yeah, no, it's because he's got you know, that really sexy voice, and he's got that really strong, you know, character, masculine character, which is, you know, very appealing. You know, for on the women's side of things, Liara is obviously designed to be a very sexual character, sensuous character, because that's her species was actually designed, you know, around that. Mass Effect Andromeda, which is otherwise a pretty appalling game.
I remember when they made Jarl bisexual, it was just like line after line of Jarl sucks. Jarl is fucking. Jarl is horny. And I'm like, good for you, internet. Enjoy this. He is very attractive. Yeah.
You got to get something out back out of Mass Effect. It was
awesome. Yeah, it might as well be Jarl.
at least we had Jarl.
Yeah.
And yeah, Dragon Age is much the same. Dragon Age has characters that are very sensuous or sexual.
Yeah.
Without being parodies or without being satires or without being so over the top that you kind of you can only laugh at them.
Yeah, I think having them worked into the ending of the story as well, in particular in Dragon Age 2, having your character and your actions or your relationship with a particular person really determine how you end up at a crucial story part of the game that affects your ability to, I guess, actually participate in combat in the last bit. I think having those ties sort of helps to make the character relationships and depictions more meaningful. I mean, obviously, it can't be satire, in my opinion, if, you know, you actually have to, you know, love and respect and, you know, and actually treat them with, like, a modicum of more than just passing affection. Like, you go through ups and downs, I think, in an RPG, especially, with your romance partners and your teammates, and I think that really sort of helps build the atmosphere. And that's what keeps it sexy and not makes it, you know, just a joke.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, The Witch is the other.
Yeah, that's right.
Off erotic.
The Witch has gotten so much better, though.
Yeah, it's because everyone's incredibly shiny and ripped and they've got impeccable pores. Like, I remember I loaded up The Witcher 3. And it is like pretty much one of the first things you see is he's just, you know, he's post-coitus with his latest girlfriend. And they're just chilling. He's chilling in the bathtub. And he's got like, he's glistening with water. He's got like his legs sticking out. His gun is barely hidden under the surface of the water. I thought that was an incredibly raunchy way to open up a game, actually.
Yeah, I thought it was great. And I think The Witcher is probably the most, you know, the most clear example of actual eroticism in games, in mainstream games anyway. And they do it really well for the most part. And nobody criticizes people who play The Witcher as being perverts, but yeah, that's neither here nor there. but yeah, I mean, Harvard, have you got any examples, I guess, of games that, you know, do sex themes in a genuine way as opposed to, you know, the laughs?
This one's gonna be like way off topic, but the whole like East and West thing you're talking about got me thinking. Do you remember back in the day where they had a Killer is Dead, and they had that game mode where you just need to stare at women and then you get power ups and whatever, and like the whole journalism world made a huge fuss about it.
Yes,
I remember playing L.A. Noire, and the first 5 missions or something like that, the murder victims were all just women, and they were entirely naked, and like a plot point was like you had to look on their naked bodies to find like evidence for the killer, and that was done in a much more exploitative, like uncomfortable way than Killer is Dead ever did, but no one mentioned that. Like, a lot of Western games just sneak in the obligatory strip club level or whatever, and like they just get away with it. Like, no one calls them out on it, even though that it's a really strange thing to do, I think. And it gets really awkward if they don't do it right, and you get to that level and you just think the developers definitely thought, okay, let's just put this there to like entice all the young men or something like that, because it just comes off as so awkward. But it just always appears. I don't understand why it keeps happening.
Yeah, it's odd. I mean, GTA is obviously very famous for throwing strip clubs into every game. And forcing you to actually go into them. It's not optional. You have a mission in there and you won't be able to progress in the game unless you go and spend time in the strip club. And yeah, I think for me, the thing is that those kinds of games do it in such a realistic way. Strip clubs obviously exist in the real world, and not that I will admit to have ever been in one, but they I imagine anyway, they behave much the same as do in GTA. No, honestly, I've never been into one, so that's yes. But yeah, for that to me is more uncomfortable, I guess, in the way that it depicts sex themes, because it is much more related to reality. Whereas, you know, Dead or Alive even the kind of the voyeuristic side of my the series with Extreme 3 is just it just doesn't exist in the real world. There's no real world kind of island where
you can stare at beautiful women and
Yeah. women without any kind of consequence and just kind of pull your camera out and take photos of them without them caring. That the Japanese seem to have this idea, this sense of fantasy versus reality, and the Japanese obviously have a line there where for them, I suspect, as long as anything that's kind of in the realm of fantasy is not something to be so concerned about. But once it crosses over that line into reality, then there is that point where people start to get uncomfortable. That's the sense I get anyway from the way that the Japanese developers work and the way that they talk about their games. And that's why we get such...
On that point, though, I do want to avoid that kind of comparison with saying, like, the Japanese way of viewing it is a bit better than the Western way or something like that. Because, of course, there are Japanese games which are super exploitative and...
Yeah, for sure.
...completely correct to just deride them for that.
Yeah, I don't think that we should, I don't think, the thing is, every game that we've talked about in the podcast today, I don't think is immune to criticism. I certainly think that there's a lot of criticism that can be leveled towards most of these games. And I think that there's a lot of the Western games are probably games that should be less criticized because they do handle the topics with more nuance and more maturity. And certainly there's the level of maturity in games like Senran Kagura is just not there. So there is criticisms that can be applied to these games. But I think that the approach that the Japanese developers make to these games is with the goal of, divorcing them from reality so that there is that line between what applies in the game world doesn't apply to the real world and vice versa. So, I guess that's why I tend to find when a game does exploitation in Western game development, it makes me more uncomfortable because it's much more closely related to reality. And this is the developers trying to recreate reality, and that's not a reality I necessarily like to see, if that makes sense. Welcome back. We'll change tone for the last section of the podcast this week, and then talk a bit about, I guess, a debate that we've been having within the DDNet team, thanks to a review that Harvard put together. He reviewed Sheffy, which is a little card game that was released on the Nintendo Switch and is also available on iOS. It was only released, what, a week ago now? And yeah, it's an interesting one because it's a game that has a particularly strong concept, theme, and narrative, which is not what you'd expect from a card game, but there you go. But there's certainly issues with the way it works mechanically. And yes, as a result of that, we've been having an ongoing debate within the DDNet team about what's kind of important in games, whether, you know, concept is enough to carry a game, whether, you know, a game that's mechanically perhaps not as refined can't possibly be considered as good as a game that is, and so on and so forth, and various, you know, degrees within that kind of debate. So, I mean, when you're listening to the podcast, pause it for a second and go and read Harvard's review of Sheffy. It's a great review. I don't necessarily agree with it, but as the editor, it's not my job to change reviews. It's to publish good ideas, and Harvard certainly has some really good ideas in that review. But yeah, I mean, once you come back, for me, Sheffy is a really distinctive and original game. And I guess when I sit down and review games, that's the first thing I look for. Yeah, is it something that I haven't seen before? Is it creative? Does it have a strong theme? Does it have a strong concept? If it does, I tend to find that I'm much more forgiving of a game than if it's really bloody well put together, but it's something I've already seen a million times before, or it doesn't have any kind of depth to it. So the obvious example there being a game like, you know, Destiny, given that Destiny 2 is around the corner, or Call of Duty, or Grand Theft Auto, or whatever. Those games don't do a whole lot for me simply because they might be really well built, but I don't find too much creativity in them. I don't find that they give me anything to think about, to be honest. I kind of bore my way through them. So, yeah, for me, something like Sheffy is a game that will stick with me a lot longer than any shooter I've played in recent years. And because of that, you know, I end up really liking it. And I imagine I'll probably be referring to it a lot down the future. I'll probably be writing about it at some point, you know, down the track as well. Because
wow, big angry, scathing counterpiece article.
I don't disagree with any of your review, Harvard. I do agree that, you know, mechanically it's an odd duck of a game. It doesn't entirely work. It's reliance on randomness, and I really don't like randomness in my games either. It's utter reliance on randomness really hurts it from a gameplay point of view. And I've been frustrated in a lot of cases that I've been playing the game, I've been really frustrated with the way it works mechanically. But, you know, it gives me an existentialist crisis. So any game that can do that, any game that can actually make me ponder on the meaning of life is probably a game that I approve of. So, you know,
that's what you really want in a game, isn't it? Just to make you get all existential by the end of it. That's all we're
looking for. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, Harvard, when you were reviewing Sheffy, yeah, you know, I know that you really enjoyed the story and you thought it had a strong concept, but yeah, did you? I mean, the mechanics really got to you to that point that you just didn't enjoy it as much as you wanted to.
Can I just say that I really love Sheffy. Like, the story is crazy. Okay. So you guys all make it sound like I gave it like a 2 out of 10. I gave it a 6 out of 10, and I think it's a great game. Everyone should go try it, play it. It's one of the most interesting things I've ever experience both on the Switch and like ever, but I think it builds upon Solitaire in a way that I think even detracts from the game, because you start to realize after playing maybe 10 or 11 times that certain cards just absolutely must be played with certain other cards. Like there's one card that says you lose the game if you play this, and there's another card that says remove another card from the game forever. every single time you play, you have to play those two cards together or you just lose.
Yeah.
And you start to realize more and more of these combinations to the point that there is just this one win state. And if you draw the wrong cards at the start, you can't win. So you just restart the game. That ruined it for me when you had to go do the story mode and you really want to see what happens next, but you're just not getting the right cards. You need to restart over and over again. Yeah, that really did kill it for me.
Yeah, for sure.
But the other thing is, I think I'm more sympathetic towards games that are really solid but don't offer anything original. Because I think that Sheffy's great, it gave a lot of new ideas, but there was so much room to improve on those ideas. Whereas I think 2 weeks ago I reviewed a game, Tokyo Xanadu, and that game is ridiculously solid. Like, I have my problems with, like you said, Destiny, where I think that a lot of it is just a Skinner box and it's not actually adding anything new. Mm-hmm. Tokyo Xanadu is the entire time you play it, rewarding gameplay, but it is also completely derivative. Like, you've seen everything in it before, but it's just so solid. I loved it. So I think that's just where I differ on my own review ethos with you guys, maybe.
Yeah, no,
I don't know. What do you guys think?
That's a good point. And like I said, I don't think there's. I appreciate the way that you review games, but I'm certainly not saying that you're doing it wrong, because that would be silly. But yeah, I mean, it's a really good idea. It's really good that you bring up Tokyo Xanadu, because, you know, the theme or the basic concept of Tokyo Xanadu is, you know, Persona-ish.
We're going to rip up Persona, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I wanted to bring it up because another game that we both played and had differing opinions about that's also Persona-ish is the Caligula Effect, which came out a little bit, a month ago now. And for me, that is more, I guess, the kind of game that I feel like I want to reward or kind of support to Tokyo Xanadu, which is, you know, really well made, but, you know, fairly derivative at times in terms of the way it presents its ideas. The Caligula Effect has a whole mess of problems with the way it plays, but the way it presents its ideas is really creative and different. And I'd never played anything like the Caligula Effect before. I've played games that are like Tokyo Xanadu. So, yeah, nothing wrong with either of the games, I don't think. I think both games certainly have a lot of merit and certainly worth people's time. I just find it really interesting the way that different people respond to those kinds of games. And, you know, as critics, how we end up reviewing them as a result. So, I mean, Ginny, in terms of where you kind of sit with all of this, I know you're a big fan of Sheffy as well.
I love Sheffy. It was a bit shocking. I mean, so my partner was like, so my partner and I have lots of like stuffed sheep and like alpacas and stuff like that. And so I was like, what better game to play on a weekend in with my partner than this game about sheep? Because I'd seen the card where they procreate and I'm like, oh, this will be quite cute. You know, it's a bit interesting. And then I load up the story mode. And then my partner's horrified. Like, she's just this fucking, about to cry. And I'm just like, this is not the day that I imagined. But it was just, it escalated so quickly. I mean, I was like, this will be a fun time. You know, we're going to have some hot cocoa. It's going to be very cute, very nice. And then suddenly I just get this look of abject horror from the person next to me. And I'm like, I think I've ruined my relationship. So,
I mean, I love how within, like, I think it's the first, you've got the prologue, which kind of sets the story up, but then the first chapter, like, this picture of the sheep with its entrails hanging out.
It was just
a very dead sheep.
It was crazy, yeah.
It's a brutal narrative. Like, it is really nihilistic and existentialist in tone, and it really hits you hard because it's quite brutal.
Yeah, it's
not what you expect from a card game, that's for sure. My wife actually saw me playing the game and I think had the same response, that she saw me playing the game and saw the kind of the cute sheep cards, and she immediately went and downloaded the app store so she could play it on her phone.
I think
she got a bit shocked by it. But my wife, being who she is, she then decided that she has to go and save every sheep. So
Oh.
He's since been playing like obsessively trying to figure out how to minimize the number of sheep casualties.
Oh.
The card game. She really loves it. She hasn't put it down since. And that's another thing, I guess. You know, if the kind of the couple of times that my wife's seen a game and become absolutely addicted to it herself tells
Yep.
me that that game has something to it as well. It doesn't happen often. Jeffy. So yeah, she was a little bit horrified when she read Harvard's review. She's like, can't you change it?
Oh, she wants to save all the sheep, Harvard.
I was like, no, but then I put
I wanted to save all the sheep too, but the game wouldn't
Yeah,
let me. That's
it's
why I
just
was
really
happy.
hard. Yeah, I don't think I'm past like chapter four or something. Like, I mean, I've finished a couple of the weird ones, but I really think that I'm not that far in. It's just because the RNG is so strong in that game.
Yeah, there's one level that's like you need 1, 3, 10, 30, like one of every type of sheep.
Yeah,
And that's
exactly.
so hard to get to. I spent like hours trying to get to that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. And I mean, your review is actually, you know, a really positive one compared to some of the others out there. I don't know if you've seen the Destructo one. Destructo, the enemy of
I
Internet at the moment. Yeah, they ripped into it. And that was a bit mean.
Yeah, they just thought it was terrible. But I mean, you know, there's no accounting for taste. You know, not everyone's got it, not everyone's born with it. But yeah,
Well, that's the other thing. These games that are, I mean, one of the things is when you are really creative about a game, when you have a really strong idea and you have a really strong sense of doing something very different, and you go out to create something very different, the inevitable reality is you're going to ups, you know, there are going to be a bunch of people that don't like what you've come up with. And you know, the reason that we have so many AAA games that stick to nice, safe formulas is because they're proven to appeal to the most people and piss off the least number of people. And creative stuff in the indie space, like in games like Sheffy, are obviously not for everybody. And that ends up, you know, following through into reviews too. You have a greater range of reactions to games like that. I mean, Deadly Premonition is probably the greatest example of that ever. Hugely creative game, hugely different, mechanically broken in a lot of ways. And the reviews for that range from, you know, 10 to 1. People who thought it was brilliant on concept and ideas and narrative. And then there were the people that could not just get past how cheaply it was played. It played in places. So that's just, I guess that's the consequence of being an artist and being creative and doing something that hasn't been done before. There's always a risk that people aren't going to like it or people will have issue with bits of it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess coming on to what you guys were talking about, you know, in terms of like idea versus execution and mechanics and what you value in a game. I mean, building off what you just said, I mean, in terms of games that are popular and genres that sell well, I mean, I love a good, you know, I love a good Persona tribute game. You know, like I love a good JRPG tribute game. Because obviously, you know what you're gonna get, and often a Western studio has their own way of spinning the narrative, which makes it, I guess, you know, an RPG is sort of a JRPG because, you know, things like relationships and concerns and culture are so different between two, you know, to, you know, an Eastern or Western studio. But I think that for me, I really highly prioritize an original idea over the mechanics. Like, I mean, the game could be 100% broken. I mean, I play League of Legends, I've used things being 100% broken. But it's just, I would really rather have a game that's got a strong idea and identifiable theme and, you know, some sort of crazy narrative than to have a game that plays incredibly well, but really it's just sort of five RPGs mashed up together, like what works from those. Because I don't know, I mean, obviously I value being able to play the game, so it can't be broken to the point whereby, I don't know, my computer has to be thrown into the gutter and destroyed. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think you had a good point, Harvard, about what you value and like how, you know, games being stable and games sort of like being predictable but also entertaining. I think it's really important that you know what you're going to get with a game. But I'm definitely someone that just goes, you know what, throw all that mechanical stuff out of the window. I'll try anything. Like, I just want the idea to be interesting. Like, if the idea grabs me from the start, I'll try it. That's really kind of my view on it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, you reviewed one yourself, Harvard, that didn't review so well with the general media, but you really enjoyed the ideas compared to some of the other examples of the genre, Mafia 3.
That was a while ago.
A while ago, but that was a game I remember getting. It got hit fairly hard by certain parts of the community because it didn't play as well as GTA or whatever. But then, you know, a lot of people, including yourself, really enjoyed the ideas versus the execution of it. So
I have like a half-finished massive opinion piece about that game that I didn't ever get to. Like, it's not even relevant anymore. But I wanted to write an article about games about the Vietnam War, which aren't set in the Vietnam War. And Mafia 3 is like massive criticism of that era of America. And there's so much I could say about it, but no one cares about the game anymore, so it's going to languish in my computer.
I don't know, I think it's still worth publishing, Harvard. You should finish
If it appears
a few months down the line, we'll see how it goes. Or if another game about Vietnam appears, I'll just sticky tape that to my old piece and we'll be done.
Well, I think one of the things
Mafia 3's DLC launches in 2 weeks. So we could actually use that excuse to throw out your piece again.
Oh, I didn't even know I was getting DLC. I have deleted it off my system. Well, we'll see how it goes.
The other thing that's really worth noting is, you know, these kinds of games that are really creative, but don't necessarily have the big impact with the critics on day one, they tend to last a lot longer. And they tend to have that kind of people keep coming back to them in the years later. Like, a good example of that is the original Nier. Was absolutely slammed by the critics when it was first released. People are now going back to it and rediscovering that, yeah, sure, it doesn't play as well as it maybe should have, but, you know, it's a brilliant game anyway, because Yoko Taro's quite the genius. And that's something we see in all kinds of forms of art, you know, throughout history. Citizen Kane was an absolute bomb when it first released, and it was only 20-odd years later that it was rediscovered. And now, of course, it's kind of the example of the pinnacle of film as an art form. And I think games like Mafia 3 will be games that people return to 20 years down the track when, you know, everybody else is on GTA
12.
Well, they'll be up to 12 by then. The rate they make them by within 20, you know, 20 years down from now, they're probably,
I bet, like by
7, maybe 8.
By 2025, there'll be like a year game franchise. Yeah. There'll be the new Assassin's Creed. Well, anyway, it'll happen.
Point is, you know, people won't be playing GTA 5 anymore. People won't necessarily remember it. It'll be kind of that piece of history within a broader series, but one that people don't feel the need to return to. I think Mafia 3, because it has those strong themes and because it has that strong message and because it's different, will be a game that people will return to and will continue to think about, talk about, write about. That's my kind of take on all of that. I think for game developers that want to make something that's kind of everlasting, doing something genuinely creative is probably the way to go. It would be interesting to see if we're still talking about Sheffy in 20 years.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, meet you guys in 10 years to talk more about Sheffy.
there's like three sequels or something to the game.
I want to make a version of Sheffy that's not as broken.
Or there could be like a strategy RPG spinoff or something.
That would ruin my heart. It's Sheffy, like Fire Emblem with like
Sheffy Revolution,
like
Sheffy Warriors.
Oh,
I know, that would be so sad.
I wouldn't handle that.
Imagine a
visual novel where it doesn't matter what choice you make, some sheep are gonna die.
Yeah. Oh no, I felt bad enough when I had to play through some of it, and like it was just, I don't know, it was just Sheffy just makes it feel so futile. Like, you know, like what you're trying to do just feels like, yeah, a waste of time because your friends are gonna die anyway. And it's so crushing.